Lecture 18, Evoking Setting and Place in Fiction.
Every story has a setting, but setting is not equally important to all stories. For some narratives, setting is just a painted theatrical backdrop against which the story plays out. And that backdrop can be changed for another one without fundamentally changing the story itself. Think of those modern dress Shakespeare productions where Richard III is played as a fascist from the 1930s, or Macbeth is played as an ambitious investment banker, or the Montagues and the Capulets in Romeo and Juliet are portrayed as rival street gangs in Miami. And it's not just Shakespeare. One of the best films ever made from a Jane Austen novel is the 1990s teen comedy Clueless. This film very successfully and surprisingly faithfully sets Austen's novel Emma in a contemporary Los Angeles high school. Here's another example. Christina Stead's brilliant novel about a dysfunctional family, The Man Who Loved Children, was originally set in Stead's native Australia. But in order to make it more appealing to American readers, she was persuaded by her publisher to move the setting to Washington, D.C. In most contemporary fiction, however, setting is important. Much of what can make a novel or story memorable is the author's careful evocation of a particular place and time. To pick two obvious examples, Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe novels are inextricably linked with Los Angeles in the middle part of the 20th century. And Flannery O'Connor's stories will be forever associated with the rural American South. An evocative and memorable setting doesn't even have to be real. Much of the appeal of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings comes from the way its characters and the reader move through the lovingly detailed landscape of Middle-earth. Tolkien's settings are so detailed and evocative that if you've read Lord of the Rings more than once, as I have, chances are you could be dropped anywhere in Middle-earth and find your way around. Setting can also mean a particular time period as well. The British novelist Hilary Mantel is famous for her attention to historical accuracy in her novels set in the court of Henry VIII, Wolf Hall, and Bring Up the Bodies. And the thrillers of Alan First owe much of their excitement to his detailed evocation of Europe during the rise of the Nazis. Another writer who is known for her evocative settings is Rosemary Sutcliffe, who is best known for her series of young adult novels about Roman Britain, The Eagle of the Ninth, The Silver Branch, and The Lantern Bearers. Each of these books skillfully evokes both the time period and the landscape of ancient Britain and Scotland. Sutcliffe had a keen appreciation of the natural world and a sharp eye for the telling detail. Of course, all fictional narratives are set somewhere, whether the particular setting is essential or not. At the very least, setting establishes a context for the characters and the plot, since not even fictional characters come out of nowhere. Sometimes it's just a backdrop. Two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona, where we lay our scene. But more often than not, setting does more in the narrative than just situating us in time and place. In this lecture, I want to talk first about some of the purposes to which setting can be put in a narrative. After that, I'll talk about how you can evoke setting in a story, which depends on the purpose of the setting. Let's start by looking at some of the ways that you can use setting in a story or a novel. In many narratives, setting can be a metaphor for the narrative as a whole. One of the most famous examples is the opening paragraph of Bleak House, Charles Dickens' great novel about a complicated and never-ending lawsuit in mid-19th century England. Here are the opening words. London, Michaelmas term lately over, and the Lord Chancellor is sitting in Lincoln's Inn Hall. Implacable November weather. As much mud in the streets as if the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth, and it would not be wonderful to meet a megalosaurus, 40 feet long or so, waddling like an elephantine lizard up Holborn Hill. Smoke lowering down from chimney pots, making a soft black drizzle with flakes of soot in it as big as full-grown snowflakes. Gone into mourning, one might imagine, for the death of the sun. Dogs, undistinguishable in mire. Horses, scarcely better, splashed to their very blinkers. foot passengers jostling one another's umbrellas in a general infection of ill temper and losing their foothold at street corners where tens of thousands of other foot passengers have been slipping and sliding since the day broke, if this day ever broke, adding new deposits to the crust upon crust of mud, sticking at those points tenaciously to the pavement and accumulating at compound interest. The next paragraph is an equally detailed and equally unsettling account of the London fog. Dickens describes how it creeps everywhere and obscures everything, how it gets into the eyes and throats of ancient pensioners by their firesides and pinches the toes and fingers of a ship's apprentice boy. And so before we ever meet a character, and before the plot even starts, Dickens has indelibly evoked a vision of dark, dirty London full of filthy animals, ill-tempered pedestrians, and poor people wheezing and shivering in the all-encompassing fog. This exceptionally vivid setting sets up two purposes. On the one hand, it vividly evokes the sensory details of London in the mind of the reader, the darkness, the cold, the dirt. On the other hand, the setting serves as a metaphor for the misty, insinuating, impenetrably foggy coils of the lawsuit itself. Here's another example. J.G. Farrell's historical novel Troubles is about the Irish rebellion against British rule in the years after World War I. The main setting is a giant resort hotel on the Irish coast called the Majestic. This Baroque old building serves all the way through the novel as a metaphor for the grand, ornate, crumbling edifice of the British Empire. At the end of the novel, the Irish Republican Army burns the hotel to the ground. The actual destruction of the hotel represents the metaphorical destruction of the dominance of Protestants and the British in Ireland. On the last page, the novel's main character, a gentle and befuddled retired British Army major, surveys the ruins, which includes the skeletons of the hundreds of cats that lived in the hotel. There is very little to see except that great collection of wash basins and lavatory bowls which had crashed from one burning floor to another until they reached the ground. He inspected the drips of molten glass which had collected like candle grease beneath the windows. He noted the large number of delicate little skeletons. The charred and roasted demons had been picked clean by the rats. He stepped from one blackened compartment to another, trying to orientate himself and saying, "I'm standing in the residence lounge, in the corridor, in the writing room." Now that these rooms were open to the mild Irish sky, they all seemed much smaller, in fact, quite insignificant. This evocative but brief excerpt can't convey the full effect of this final scene, but take my word for it. The vast, crumbling, mostly empty Majestic is an oppressive presence all the way through the whole book, with its clueless Anglo-Irish owners, its sullen Irish servants, and a surrounding countryside seething with resentment. Even if he or she doesn't know anything about the history of the Irish Revolution, every reader will understand that in that final scene, the major is surveying the ruins of an empire, and not just a burnt-out old hotel. I want to emphasize that each of these two settings, foggy, dirty London in Bleak House and the Majestic Hotel in Troubles, are also full of vivid sensory details that draw you into the scene and into the book. They put you in the moment, even if you aren't consciously picking up on the metaphor. A setting should be visceral and vivid, even when you are using it for a metaphorical purpose. Whatever its symbolic intent, a carefully evoked setting should allow us to experience that imaginary world as if we were characters in the story. You can also use setting to evoke mood, especially when the point of the book is to evoke a strong vicarious emotion. This is especially true in genre fiction such as horror, where you want to evoke fear in a reader. Here's part of a description of a haunted house from the early pages of Judith Hawk's marvelously creepy novel, Julian's House. Inside the gate, so overgrown with honeysuckle that it no longer swings freely but seems to protest against being opened, the yard slopes ever so slightly down to the house, and you may find your pace quickening in spite of yourself as you approach. The broad flagstones leading the way are cracked now and worn with the pressure of feet going back and forth across them. Grass springs up in the cracks, and the once sharp edges are soft with moss. Inside the gate, a silence falls. Leaves stir and are still. At the foot of the porch steps, the silence deepens, wrapped around with the fragrance of the shallow pink roses that twine the uprights and shadow the wide boards with their leaves. And yet it is more than a silence, as the leaves stir and again are still. It is a silence of breath held, of a sob stifled in a pillow, the silence that follows the blow of a fist upon a table. In the moving leaves, this silence seems to murmur in its sleep, of too many closed doors, keys turning smoothly in well-oiled locks, glances exchanged without words. Even if we hadn't already been told that this is a haunted house, it would be hard to read this description and not sense immediately that there is something wrong with this house, that there is something bad waiting inside. There are a lot of nifty little details in this passage, but I'll just point out one. You might not notice it on a first reading, but Hawkes uses the word silence 6 times in the paragraph. Normally, the repetition of a word that many times in so short a passage is anathema to writers, or at least to copy editors. But here the repetition has the effect of making the silence ominous, like a thundercloud building on the horizon. More importantly, the word silence is paired with such active verbs as falls, deepens, and murmur. The use of these verbs changes the silence from the absence of sound to an active presence in the house. This is a very skillful bit of scene setting. You could also use setting to tell us about the characters in a story. A description of a room or a house is often used to tell us something about the person who lives there. One of the major plot lines in George Eliot's Middlemarch is the ill-advised marriage of Dorothea Brooke, an intense young woman in her early 20s, to Edward Casaubon, a dry and humorless scholar who is 30 years her senior. Early in the book, after their surprise engagement, Dorothea goes to visit Mr. Casaubon's home. The building, of greenish stone, was in the old English style, not ugly, but small-windowed and melancholy-looking, the sort of house that must have children, many flowers, open windows, and little vistas of bright things to make it seem a joyous home. In this latter end of autumn, with a sparse remnant of yellow leaves falling slowly athwart the dark evergreens in a stillness without sunshine, the house, too, had an air of autumnal decline, and Mr. Casaubon, when he presented himself, had no bloom that could be thrown into relief by that background. Now, even if the reader hadn't already begun to suspect that Dorothea's marriage to Casaubon was a bad idea, this description should make up his mind. Nearly everything Eliot says about the house, that it's small-windowed and melancholy, that the grounds around it are dark, still, and without sunshine, and that it has an air of autumnal decline, could also be said about Casaubon himself. The last clause of the passage is one of the great backhanded insults in English literature, when Eliot says that there is nothing about Casaubon himself that could be thrown into relief by his joyless home. Setting can also be used to evoke the passage of time and the movement of characters through a landscape. Tolkien is especially skillful at describing the geography of Middle-earth. In part, this is simply because he delights in evoking the natural world. But these passages also literally slow the narrative down, and this has the effect of evoking the slow passage of characters who are moving on foot through a vast and often spectacular landscape. Here are the hobbits Frodo and Sam passing through the land of Ithilien in the Two Towers. Day was opening in the sky, and they saw that the mountains were now much further off, receding eastward in a long curve that was lost in the distance. Before them, as they turned west, gentle slopes ran down into dim hazes far below. All about them were small woods of resinous trees, fir and cedar and cypress, and other kinds unknown in the Shire, with wide glades among them, and everywhere there was a wealth of sweet-smelling herbs and shrubs. The long journey from Rivendell had brought them far south of their own land, but not until now, in this more sheltered region, had the hobbits felt the change of clime. Here spring was already busy about them. Fronds pierced moss and mold, larches were green-fingered, small flowers were opening in the turf, birds were singing. Ithilien, the garden of Gondor now desolate, kept still a disheveled dryad loveliness. This lovely passage evokes both the vastness of the landscape through which Frodo and Sam are moving, as well as their own sense of wonder at it. Notice how the passage effectively shifts our focus from the long distance to the close up. We see the mountains as a long curve that was lost in the distance. But in the next sentence, we get particular types of trees, fir and cedar and cypress. And finally, we get the individual harbingers of spring, fronds piercing moss, green-fingered larches, flowers opening in the turf. And the fact that the reader is required to slow down during this passage and to stop and smell the flowers also evokes the slowness of Frodo and Sam's journey. But setting doesn't have to slow down the narrative. You can also use setting to evoke speed and danger. Here's part of a chase scene from Rosemary Sutcliffe's The Eagle of the Ninth. Her two main characters, the Roman soldier Marcus and his slave Esca, are fleeing on horseback across the Scottish Highlands from a band of Pictish tribesmen. He was riding for his life with the dark hunt in full cry behind him, putting out all his skill to keep clear of hidden pitfalls, the hummocks and snags and snarls among the heather that might bring disaster, grimly aware that he could not grip strongly enough with his right knee, and if the pony stumbled at this flying gallop, he would go clean over its head. On and on they hurtled, now skirting a reed-fringed upland pool, now swerving from a patch of bog luminously green in the fading light, uphill and down, through bronze tides of dying heather, startling here a flock of plover, there a stray curlew from the bents, and always, behind them, the hunt drawing nearer. Marcus could hear the hounds giving tongue above the soft thunder of the pony's hooves, nearer, steadily nearer, but there was no time for looking back. Here, as in Tolkien, we can delight in the vivid evocation of the landscape in its own right, the luminous green bogs, the bronze tides of dying heather. But we should also note how Sutcliffe skillfully interweaves the flashes of landscape description with breathless action. It should be obvious from the examples we've already looked at that there are many different ways to evoke setting in fiction. As always, the various methods for evoking setting fall between two ends of a continuum. At one end, you evoke setting by stopping the narrative dead in its tracks and describing a place or time period in detail. At the other end, you barely evoke setting at all. In general, the method of stopping the narrative in its tracks is used in narratives such as Bleak House or Troubles, where the setting is important to the story. At the other extreme, when the setting isn't that important to the story, you simply don't bother with it. Most novels and short stories fall somewhere in between, combining the various methods. Let's take a look at some examples. We'll start with the two opposite poles and then examine some examples that fall somewhere in between. In narratives that rely upon standalone descriptions of setting, the point of view the writer is using determines how she evokes the setting. The omniscient third person is going to be more cinematic, like an objective camera eye. Take the opening of Bleak House that we looked at earlier. It's like a crane shot in a movie, one that starts high up, smoke lowering down from chimney pots, making a soft black drizzle, then slowly descends to street level, dogs undistinguishable in mire. There it becomes a tracking shot, showing us the masses of Londoners struggling through the mud and the fog, but not from any individual person's point of view, foot passengers jostling one another's umbrellas in a general infection of ill temper. And remember, this passage does two things simultaneously. It gives our mind's eye something to look at, and it introduces a central metaphor for the plot. Now, when a standalone set piece description of setting is told from the limited third person or the first person point of view, it also does one more thing, namely, it evokes character. How the character sees the setting, what details he or she picks out as important, tell us something about the person through whose eyes we, the readers, are seeing them. J.G. Farrell's Troubles is told in the close third person from the point of view of Major Archer, a shell-shocked veteran of World War I. A diffident and sometimes befuddled man, Archer walks through the burnt-out ruins of the Majestic at the end of the book and merely takes note of the melted glass and the skeletons of dead cats. The metaphorical intent of the scene is lost on the Major. He does not draw any of the connections between the Majestic Hotel and the British Empire. Instead, it's the author who makes that connection, by using that narrative double consciousness that I talked about in a previous lecture. In the last sentence of the paragraph I quoted earlier, Farrell writes, "Now that these rooms were open to the mild Irish sky, they all seemed much smaller, in fact, quite insignificant." This is an oblique, sly, but sharp comment about the end of empire, and it doesn't come from Major Archer, but from the author. A setting can become even more multi-layered when it is described from the first-person point of view. A few minutes ago, I said that setting is part of the appeal of the novels of Raymond Chandler because of the way he records the city of Los Angeles during a particular time in its history. But what makes the setting especially distinctive in Chandler is the fact that it is seen through the eyes and mind of Chandler's main character and protagonist, the private detective Philip Marlowe. Here's the second paragraph of Chandler's first novel, The Big Sleep, in which Marlowe is entering the Los Angeles mansion of a rich client named General Sternwood. The main hallway of the Sternwood place was two stories high. Over the entrance doors, which would have let in a troop of Indian elephants, there was a broad stained glass panel showing a knight in dark armor rescuing a lady who was tied to a tree and didn't have any clothes on, but some very long and convenient hair. The knight had pushed the visor of his helmet back to be sociable, and he was fiddling with the knots on the ropes that tied the lady to the tree and not getting anywhere. I stood there and thought that if I lived in the house, I would sooner or later have to climb up there and help him. He didn't seem to be really trying. This goes on for another couple of paragraphs, but this is enough to make my point. This paragraph does several things all at once. First, it sets the scene visually so we know where we are. Second, it tells us right from the start that General Sternwood is very rich, an impression that is immediately reinforced by the next two paragraphs and several other passages of description later in the chapter. Third, it tells us a good deal about Marlowe himself. We learn that he is an alert, sharp-eyed, and witty observer of his surroundings. We learn that he quickly takes the measure of his environment and the people he meets. Fourth, the stained glass window with the knight and the naked lady foreshadows the plot. General Sternwood is being blackmailed by a photographer who has taken nude pictures of his youngest daughter. Marlowe is being hired to become, in effect, the knight in dark armor whose job it is to free her from the pornographer's clutches. Let's take a look now at a writer who scarcely evokes setting at all, at least not in the modern sense, Jane Austen. Compared to a modern writer, Austen hardly ever describes anything, either settings or characters. Mr. Darcy is the leading man of Pride and Prejudice, and here is the only physical description he gets in the entire book. Mr. Darcy drew the attention of the room by his fine, tall person, handsome features, noble mien. That's it. That's all we get of him, a description that could fit any number of men. Well, the same goes for Austen's evocations of setting. Her description of Mr. Darcy's mansion, Pemberley, is slightly more extensive than her description of Darcy himself, but not by much. "The eye was instantly caught by Pemberley House, situated on the opposite side of the valley, into which the road with some abruptness wound. It was a large, handsome stone building, standing well on rising ground and backed by a ridge of high woody hills. And in front, a stream of some natural importance was swelled into greater, but without any artificial appearance." That's all there is, and none of it is particularly evocative. Note in particular the abstract adjectives she uses to describe the house itself, as opposed to the landscape in which it sits. All she tells us about the house is that it is large, handsome, and made of stone. Just as Darcy's description could describe half the titled landowners in England, the description of his home could fit nearly every other English country house at the time. And yet, it's not fair to say that Austen was completely uninterested in evoking setting. Jane Austen could rely upon the fact that she and her readers shared a social and geographical context, and so she could use a kind of shorthand. Reading novels was still mostly an elite practice in Austen's day. She knew that her educated readers would recognize the real places she cited in the text and then be able to interpolate the nature and approximate location of the fictional places. The village of Longbourn in Pride and Prejudice, for example, is fictional, but it is situated in the real English county of Hertfordshire, and Austen could count on her readers knowing what Hertfordshire looks like. In the same novel, another family, the Gardiners, live on Gracechurch Street, a real street in London, and Austen knew that her readers would know where Gracechurch Street is and what sort of people live there. Put it in modern terms, you might say that Jane Austen was relying on the brand names of her day to evoke setting, which is a technique many of our contemporary writers rely upon. The crime thrillers of George Pelecanos, for example, are very specifically set in Washington, D.C., and they are often set in a specific year. He evokes the time period by telling you what pop songs a character hears on the radio, and he often describes characters by telling us the brand names of their clothes. On the very first page of his novel, The Cut, for example, we're told that the main character, Spiro Lucas, is wearing Carhartt jeans and that he's taking notes in a black moleskin notebook. And throughout the novel, Pelecano skillfully combines real street and place names with brief bits of description. Here's a passage in which Spiro Lucas drives out of the city and then rides his bicycle to reconnoiter a suspicious location. He drove out to Hyattsville, Maryland, via Queens Chapel Road and Hamilton Street, and stopped in the lot of the 38th Street Park, through which ran the paved Northwest Branch Trail. He got onto his bike and pedaled southeast, staying in the middle gears, through open fields, past woods, across Rhode Island Avenue, and finally across alternate Route 1, navigating through fast vehicular traffic. He dipped down into Tanglewood Drive, entered the industrial district of Edmonston, and cruised at a steady place. All of these places are real. You can get on Google Street View, like I did when I read The Cut, and follow this route in every detail. The downside to a description like this is that if you don't know Hyattsville, Maryland, as well as Spiro Lucas or George Pelecanos do, your eye is likely to glide over these names. On the other hand, the author's use of these real place names bespeaks an authority and an intimacy with the setting that can be just as compelling to a reader as a more detailed description. In the context of a fast-paced thriller, this sort of description may even be more compelling. Even if you have never crossed Rhode Island Avenue through traffic, the passage evokes the confidence and expertise of Spiro Lucas. And, of course, there's that vast middle ground of narratives between those that use standalone set-piece descriptions and those that rely simply on place names. Let's go back to that breathless chase scene from Rosemary Sutcliffe's The Eagle of the Ninth and look at one particular sentence. On and on they hurtled, now skirting a reed-fringed upland pool, now swerving from a patch of bog luminously green in the fading light, uphill and down, through bronze tides of dying heather, startling here a flock of plover, there a stray curlew from the bents, and always behind them the hunt drawing nearer. Note how this long sentence starts with action, on and on they hurtled, and then launches into a series of adjective phrases with a participle at the end of each phrase, skirting, swerving, startling. Each one of these adjective phrases modifies the pronoun they at the beginning of the sentence. Now note how within each phrase, the participle is linked with a vivid feature of the landscape, skirting a reed-fringed upland pool, swerving round a patch of bog, startling a flock of plover. In this way, Sutcliffe skillfully evokes both motion and landscape, not only in the same paragraph, not only in the same sentence, but in the same phrase. Now, whether you choose to lavish your reader with a richly detailed technicolor description or just say that your detective walked into a Starbucks, remember that in most cases, how you use setting depends on the overall purpose of your narrative. Scene by scene, you want to lavish detailed descriptions on settings that recur or are especially important. But you only need a line or two to evoke settings that don't matter as much or that only turn up once. If a particular setting looms over the whole narrative, the way the majestic hotel looms over J.G. Farrell's novel Troubles, then you will constantly return to the setting as the story goes on, the way Farrell does. If you want to evoke the slow passage of travelers on foot across a landscape, then you will slow the narrative down for long descriptions of that landscape, the way Tolkien does in Lord of the Rings. But if you want to evoke an intense, energetic, young private investigator speeding on his bicycle through a modern-day industrial park, you want to pick up the pace and just use place names, the way George Pelicanos does in The Cut. Now, here are a couple of different exercises you could try in order to explore the use of setting in a narrative. As I said earlier, one of the things you can do with setting is evoke character. So try describing the same setting from the point of view of two different characters who want different things. Take Sarah and Brad, for example, the unhappily married couple in my narrative from the first lecture. As you may recall, they're at a baseball game. So try describing the ballpark in two different ways. Show it first from Sarah's point of view, bearing in mind that she's about to ask for a divorce, and then show it from Brad's, bearing in mind that he has no idea what she's about to ask him. You could also explore just how important a particular setting is to a narrative by taking a famous novel or story and setting it in a radically different place or time from the original. As I said at the start of this lecture, people do this with Shakespeare all the time, and even with Jane Austen upon occasion. But you could rewrite a scene from, say, Huckleberry Finn that was set someplace other than the Mississippi. Or could one of the scenes from The Great Gatsby take place at any other place or time other than Long Island in the Jazz Age? Meanwhile, in the next lecture, I'll be talking about pacing in fiction, and we'll be looking at a variety of works, including Leo Tolstoy's novella The Death of Ivan Ilyich, Alice Munro's great short story The Beggar Maid, and Eleanor Catton's Booker Prize-winning novel The Luminaries, and John le Carré's classic spy thriller Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.